This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Love to eat? How about only eating food that's good for you? Well, how about eating food that's good for you, completely satisfying, keeps you happy, and not just prevents illness but may even cure it? Not possible, you say. Well, before you commit to that conclusion, you'll want to hear from this hour's guests. One who researches nutrition in his role as a college professor. Another who heads up nutrition consulting for an endocrinology-based medical group. Plus, a family physician who, after trying some of these food approaches for himself, now enthusiastically recommends them to his patients. We can't promise you won't find yourself getting hungry in the hour ahead, but chances are you will find your mind filled with truly nutritious insight if you stay tuned for the conversation coming up right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Food is our focus this hour. Got thoughts about it? Questions on what's good for you, what's not? About conflicting claims concerning what kind of nutrition is supposedly best for all of us? Or whether what we eat really matters at all? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. Later in the program, we hope to connect by phone with a Charlottesville physician who says he's had remarkable success recommending certain kinds of nutrition plans to his patients. Nutrition plans influenced by at least one of today's in-studio guests. So more about that in a moment. But we need to make sure you know you are invited to join this conversation. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And by phone, 888-967-2825. Okay, Jeremy Akers, registered dietitian, nutrition researcher, and faculty member in the Department of Health Sciences at James Madison University. Dr. Akers, great to see you back in the Insight Studio.
I'm excited to be here today. Thank you, Tom.
With us for the very first time, another registered dietitian and director of nutrition for the Scottsville, Virginia-based medical group that calls itself the Revolution Health Center, Robin Cole. Thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Well, Robin, since this is your first time, let's go to you first. I understand that alkalinity, alkaline nutrition plans, changing the pH of people's bodies through what they eat is a really big focus for you and the folks at Revolution Health Center. Tell us what that means, what it is, and why you think it's such a big deal.
All right, that's a loaded question, but so our bodies are actually, when we talk about alkalinity and acidity, it's on a scale of pH. So if you kind of take yourself back to your high school chemistry classroom, you've probably heard about pH at one point or another. Well, our bodies function at kind of this optimal pH, and it's actually slightly alkaline, very, very slightly above neutral. But what's happened is in our food system, it's filled with a lot of these acidic foods. So we're talking animal foods, processed foods, coffee, sugar, alcohol, refined flour.
And those all create acidity in our bodies?
Yes, those all create acidity. So when I'm talking about acidity and alkalinity, I'm really talking about what's happening when it goes inside your body, when it becomes metabolized. Because something like lemon or lemon juice is going to be acidic on the outside of the body, but once we put it inside, it actually turns alkaline. So thinking about things once they go in is what I'm referring to when I talk about acidity and alkalinity.
And that's one of the reasons dairy products are a big no-no on your list, because milk may be alkaline outside your body, but inside your body it creates a good deal of acidity?
Well, dairy in general is acidic. I wouldn't necessarily say that dairy was super, super alkaline at all, inside or outside of the body. But dairy, even farther than or beyond an alkalinity acidity perspective, is the inflammatory property of the protein casein, which is what we find in dairy. And there's been, you know, lots of research done on casein and its actually ability to
Casein. That's a type of protein.
So when you separate dairy, you separate into casein, you separate it into whey.
And so the other thing that you look at when you're recommending nutrition plans for people who come to your health group, which is basically an endocrinology-based medical center run by Dr. Zach Bush, an endocrinologist, What you're doing is trying to get people to reduce the acidity in their body and to reduce inflammation caused by diet?
Absolutely. And as a whole, I would definitely expand on the endocrinology piece. Zach Bush is the endocrinologist. We get a lot of endocrinology, but within the last year, we've actually expanded into a family practice as well. So we have a family practice doctor there. So kind of looking at it all, endocrinology is a huge piece of people's health, which I think is a lot of what we do there too, hormonal balance and everything like that.
It is going to be interesting to lots of people listening, Robin Cold, that a gentleman who for a long time was sort of a traditional medical practice endocrinologist a few years ago sets up this new practice because, at least as he's told the story, he was getting less and less satisfied with the pharmaceutical approach to mm-hmm. medicine. And he thought one of the reasons he brought you and other nutritionists in is he thought foods and what we eat plays a huge role in whether or not we get healthy and stay healthy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What do you think about everything you've heard so far, Dr. Jeremy Akers?
Well, when you look at the alkaline diet, you know, there are little flaws into that. I do agree with a lot of the practices. But if you look at some of the newer research, there was a review paper done last year, and a lot of the research is kind of flawed because they're comparing an alkaline diet to a diet that is like a traditional American type of diet. And the unfortunate thing is that, and I totally agree with the premises of when you get rid of, you know, sugar and high fat and very energy dense foods and go more to a, you know, more of a natural type of way of eating, of course, that you are going to be healthier.
Do I understand correctly, Jeremy, that the first issue you take is with what you call the traditional American diet?
Yes.
Which is
a very high fat, high sodium, high sugar type of diet.
And so what you're saying is if you change people to an alkaline diet, you're automatically going to have improvements.
Oh, yes.
Because you're taking people away from foods that are bad for us, whether they are high in acidity or not?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not the food itself that's acidic. It's how your body actually metabolizes that. Our body is an amazing function. You know, looking at endocrinology and looking at how we actually digest, metabolize, and actually throw out a word, homeostasis. Our body is phenomenal at being able to take these foods. If you know, again, they are, you know, the way they metabolize, they do become acidic. But if you look at our blood pH, which if you look at the pH, you know, neutral is a 7.0. And with the alkaline diet, that's normal. Our blood is around a 7.35 to a 7.45. And our blood, no matter, you know, whatever happens, whether you exercise a lot, exercise is induced inflammation, and it produces a lot of lactic acid. Even if you are in an exercise state, your body is still very efficient at maintaining that because we have to. If not, I mean, we could cause this thing called acidosis that we could actually die from. So our body is very functional and very efficient at making sure that we maintain this balance. A lot of the testing is kind of looking more at like the urine, which, you know, a lot of different foods can kind of change.
But what I'm not hearing, Jeremy, here is if our body does such wonderful stuff with whatever we ingest, why it is we should care about what we ingest?
Because we have an abundance of it. And then if you look at a lot of the abundance of higher fat foods, higher sugar foods, and, you know, again, I don't know how in depth you want to get with metabolic regulation. And,
actually, what I'd really like to hear is both of your ideas on what it would be good for us to be eating that would not only make our innards in our body happy, but that we'd feel satisfied and happy on the outside as well. So I'll ask you more about that in a moment. But for anybody who's just joined us, I should note that this is Virginia Insight. Registered dietitian from James Madison University, Jeremy Akers, is one of our guests. And registered dietitian from the Revolution Healthcare Center in Scottsville, Virginia, Robin Cole, is another one of our guests. So, Robin, I take it that you are recommending very specific things to the people who come into your health center with medical problems. Are there any constants? Are there any kinds of foods that you tell people it would be really good if you were eating more of this?
Absolutely. Kind of spinning off what Jeremy has said about our blood being able and our body being able to balance that pH, it can balance. It does balance that pH at an expense. So when we become too acidic, our bodies actually breathe out, pee out, or sweat out that acidity. Those are the three kind of routes where we get rid of it. But because
so tell me what I should eat that's going to make my body happy and make me happy.
What should you eat? Micronutrient dense foods. And at the end of the day, those are plant foods. There's going to be no micronutrients that are going to be in dairy. You're just not going to find that. And the minerals that we need.
What about stuff like CLA, which we get an abundance of CLA from dairy, from especially grass-fed. When you're looking at things that are not latent with hormones and antibiotics, we got things like our beta carotene.
For those of us
eggs.
Who are undereducated, could you tell us what CLA is?
Conjugated linoleic acid.
Okay.
So this is a usually you get this mainly from ruminants. You get it from the ruminants of like cattle, sheep, and goats. So like you get it from the dairy products. Again, I'm kind of more mm-hmm. of like the key for the yogurt, getting into the probiotics. But CLAs, omega-3s, beta carotene, these are all products that we can get from dairy sources, and also like high amounts of it as well, dairy sources, and also some of our meats.
So it sounds like on one side here we have Jeremy Akers, who is pro-dairy in the diet. And on the other side, we have another registered dietitian, Robin Cole, who is anti-dairy.
I would not. Yes.
Okay.
Certainly
we got
anti-dairy.
That settled.
Yes.
But let's see what else. You said lots of plant foods.
Absolutely. So we're talking about micronutrients and minerals that are going to be nourishing your cells.
So we're talking about apples and spinach.
We're primarily talking about vegetables, also fruits. So kale, collard, spinach, apples, all that good stuff, primarily in season. And then, nuts and seeds. So when you think about an alkalinity acidity, I'm talking on a spectrum. So Jeremy here is talking about grass-fed beef. Grass-fed beef is completely different than a grain-fed piece of meat in this American food industry. Same thing goes for, we could go into dairy. That could be an entire show in and of itself. So I don't.
Okay, we'll
get,
save that for another time.
Yeah, I don't.
We've established
too
the borderlines there.
Yeah, so we're talking about an alkalinity acidity spectrum, where a piece of grass-fed beef is completely different than a piece of corn-fed beef. Just like milk straight from the cow that's raw, that's unpasteurized. I'm not advocating for that, but that's completely different than whey protein isolate you find in powder form in the grocery store. So we're talking about fruits and vegetables, and then the more food has been processed, the more acidic it's going to be. So the same thing goes for either whey straight from the cow's milk or into a bar, or the same thing as even something as simple as wheat, where you're looking at a wheat berry versus something that's been processed all the way down to white flour.
Out of the corner of my eye, Jeremy Akers, it seems to me that I saw you nodding at one point in agreement with Ms. Cole, and I think she was saying something about the more food is processed, in essence, the worse it is for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you got to think that's not the way that nature intended it.
So you agree with her about it?
Yeah, like I said, there's a lot of parts of the ASH diet, the alkaline diet, that I totally agree with. I think.
Well, it also sounds the more that I'm eating kale, the happier Robin's going to be. Is that
Oh, yeah. Kale's awful. Kale chips. You need to try kale chips.
Yes.
It's a great new superfood right now. I totally agree. And I'm really glad that Robin kind of brought that out, is that the American diet, really, I would say, 70-80, actually it's getting a little bit more popular now, but 70-80% do not go and buy grass-fed beef. They buy stuff that has been added with hormones and added with antibiotics.
And you think that causes health problems?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Such as?
When you look at things like exogenous types of toxins that are actually in the food, again, you're getting into the whole spectrum of how our food system runs.
So do you think I'm more likely to have inflammation in my body or more likely to get cancer or something in between?
Prime example, one of the things that they give baby chickens to make them grow is arsenic. It's a prime example. And I have, there's tons and tons of other things that they actually give food.
Minimizing the degree to which we ingest arsenic when we eat chicken would be a good thing.
Yeah, we definitely need to minimize arsenic.
You can tell from the music we've got to pause for a break here. We have registered dietitians and nutritionists, sort of combination both there. Jeremy Akers and Robin Cole, they can talk much better than I can, and they will do more in a moment. in her work as director of nutrition at a medical group in Scottsville, Virginia, Robin Cole advises individual patients on what kinds of foods are most likely to help with health issues and which foods may hurt. Ms. Cole also offers a wide range of nutrition and meal plan advice in her online blog, The Real RD, in which we're pretty sure RD stands for Registered Dietitian. In his work as a faculty member in the Department of Health Sciences at James Madison University, Jeremy Akers studies and teaches about nutrition. Dr. Akers, Ms. Cole, our in-studio guests here on Virginia Insight. My name, dude, I'm not eating the right things. I can't make my tongue work today. I'm Tom Graham, and joining us now by phone is a family practice physician who we understand has been giving a lot of attention lately to food. He is co-founder of the Downtown Family Health Center in Charlottesville, Dr. Greg Gelbard. So good to have you back on the Inside Airwaves. It's been far too many years, Greg, since we've had you here.
It's good to be back on the show. If you'll have to excuse me, I was just finishing a Snickers when you called.
Oh, do we have to talk to him now?
Yeah, you
just
do.
Kidding, just kidding.
Sorry.
So anti-inflammatory diet is something that do I understand correctly that you kind of got onto for yourself after consulting with the folks where Robin works, the Revolution Health Center?
That's true. I met with Zach, not as a consult, but just to find out what he was doing down there a few years ago. And
Zach Bush is the one who started Revolution.
I'm sorry. You're right. Yeah, Dr.
Okay.
Bush. And I had known about the alkaline diet for a few years as a way to prevent inflammation in general and also to help fight cancer. And so after eating a meal with Zach, I realized that he was onto something. And I thought, you know, I have nothing to lose. And I'm going to be recommending this veganish type diet to patients, especially diabetics, but other people who also have inflammatory issues. And so I did it myself very strictly for about 6 months. And then I kind of relaxed a little bit after I realized what its benefits were. And now I eat what I call a veganish diet. I'll eat fish on occasion, but I pretty much avoid most other meats and certainly dairy. And I found some great results. I guess you want to know what they are.
Absolutely.
Okay. So I have minor joint problems, mostly from long time running. And most of those bone issues disappeared. My energy increased. I've always been pretty energetic. I exercise 5 days a week generally, and I try to get enough sleep. And I meditate and pray and try to live my life as balanced as I can.
Mm-hmm.
The vegan diet really added to all that and helped my energy. And I never felt like I had a meal again that weighed on me.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I experimented with a local barbecue place a few months ago, just because everybody's been raving about it, and we don't usually eat meat, but we thought, oh, well, let's give it a try. And honestly, it took me about a day to recover. And it wasn't that it was bad food. It was very tasty. It's just that meat and things like that are very heavy and hard to digest.
Mm-hmm.
And so what people find when they are on a more alkaline, anti-inflammatory diet is that that the meal doesn't weigh them down, and it energizes them.
Dr. Gelbard, I take it after you found that you were having good results for your own health with this change in nutrition, you started recommending it to patients. What did they report back to you?
So pretty much the same thing, especially those who have specific inflammatory issues or have diabetes. Those with diabetes, for example, lost weight, went down on their medications, a few have gone off. And sometimes, frankly, when I have a hard time convincing somebody that they really should be on a more anti-inflammatory or vegan diet, I will send them to Dr. Bush, because Dr. Bush is a better salesperson than I am. I think part of it is his personality. Part of it is also that he has such a broad background in the specifics, the physiology of these processes, that he can relay that so well to his patients that they really understand what he's trying to get at. And I'm not quite sure I'm so good at it.
Dr. Greg Gelbert is with us by phone for only a few more minutes. We've actually pulled him away from his patients, and they want him back. So if you want to talk to him, please get your phone call into us right now at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. Nutrition specialist Jeremy Akers and Robin Cole are going to be with us for a few more minutes, but it'd be good to get your phone call in for them, too. And we have a question here that could be for any of the three of you that's come in on our Facebook page. Greg, I'll toss it to you first, and if you don't want it, the other two can pick it up. This is from Jennifer, who says, what is the difference between prebiotics and probiotics? Is there really such a thing as prebiotics, or was that just something somebody created in order to be able to sell a whole new type of food supplement?
No, there are definitely certain foods that we eat or can eat that help feed the normal flora in our gut. And I'm imagining Robin knows those foods better than I do. So I'll pass the microphone to her.
Yeah, absolutely. So prebiotics are going to be that good stuff that you're putting through your digestive system in order to essentially get your gut healthy, get that entire microflora healthy, which is an entire biome in and of itself. And those foods are going to be really fruits and vegetables at the end of the day. Really, really good things that are full of micronutrients and things that are going to actually nourish your bacteria. Then you're looking at also, you know, fermented foods that are going to be have all kinds of good stuff in them as well. Like,
so what is a prebiotic? I've always understood that a probiotic is something that puts good microbes, good bacteria back into your gut.
Well,
so what is a prebiotic?
Well,
do?
A prebiotic feeds the probiotics. That's
yes.
Pretty much what, I mean, the prebiotics are food for the probiotics. Prebiotics are things, you know, like the fibrous types, cruciferous types of vegetables.
So a prebiotic is going to nurture the microbes
they're
that
good.
Are in my
mm-hmm.
gut
they're
and
good.
And make them multiply and be happy and healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And help things pass through, help the cell linings fluff off, help mm-hmm. you know, pass things through. Things like, you know, if you have intestinal cramps, if you have things like diarrhea, if you have constipation, all these things, these good bacteria, you know, that's what the prebiotics do. They feed those, and then the probiotics are what really helps our gut health.
Dr. Gelbert, before you go, I think, first of all, you undersell yourself as a salesperson. But it does seem to me that you must struggle with patients, whether you persuade them or someone that you recommend them to as a specialist persuades them to try new types of foods and new types of nutrition plans, because people are going to say, you know, I want to feel satisfied when I eat. I want to feel like I'm eating something that I enjoy eating. What's the response once you actually sell them on trying the difference? Do they still complain about not being satisfied?
Yes. And so I tell them to do what I do, which I call grazing. And so it's true that if I ate a huge meal of, let's say, a cheese omelet in the morning with three eggs, I could go easily from 7 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock in the afternoon before wanting lunch. But when I'm eating my peanut butter and apple or peanut butter and banana and a piece of high-grain bread in the morning, by 10 o'clock, I'm grabbing a handful of cashews or I'm eating one of my vegan snacks that I get from the natural food store, and I'm making it another 2 or 3 hours. But I definitely have to eat more often. And that's just a secret that we have and something that we just have to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's probably healthier anyway to eat smaller meals more often.
Absolutely. And right along with what you're saying, you're having to eat more often because plants get through your gut way faster than meat or dairy does. I mean, plants are passing through there within 1 to 2 hours versus...
Okay, we've got maybe 60 seconds before we got to let Greg get back to his patients before they riot over there in Charlottesville. do either of you have a question before we let him off the phone?
No, I guess my only question to Greg is that, you know, before you tried this alkaline diet, did you try things we were talking about before, is lowering your meat consumption where you're not eating as much as a typical diet, a typical American, and then also going more to a grass-fed type of beef? And then were there any differences then if you tried that, or did you just go straight to the veganism?
Actually, I've been pretty vegetarian for 30 years, but I do recommend that if my patients do eat meat, and I tell them they don't have to quit meat, But I definitely say, as you do, that they really should be eating the natural meat the way God intended. In other words, mm-hmm. no corn, grass-fed, organic if possible, and certainly free-range in the meat, the eggs, the chicken, you know, all that.
Mm-hmm. Greg Gelbert, once again, a family practice physician and co-founder of Charlottesville Downtown Family Health Center. Greg, thank you so very much for making
thank
time
you all.
For us. Thank your patience for us, too, please. Have a great rest of the day. We still have here in the studio at Virginia Insight registered dietitian from James Madison University, Jeremy Akers, and registered dietitian from the Revolution Health Center in Scottsville, Virginia, Robin Cole. My name's Tom Graham. We got some phone lines open at 888-967-2825. But a few minutes ago, Mark used that number from Edinburgh. Mark, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Thanks, Tom. I was wondering if any of your guests can comment on the benefits of fermented foods, such as miso and kimchi, and I'll take their comments also. Thanks.
Okay, and before you go, I just want to make sure we had a little trouble with the line there. Was it kimchi?
Kimchi. Yeah.
Kimchi.
Kimchi. Okay, miso and kimchi. Thanks for the question, Mark.
Absolutely. Miso and kimchi are great, along with other fermented foods like kombucha tea or unpasteurized sauerkraut. And what those are doing is essentially getting those microflora in your gut healthy, not only maintaining gut health, but also after, you know, a round of antibiotics or something. I certainly would not recommend antibiotics to anybody unless absolutely necessary. But those are ways that you can actually restore your gut health, get the microflora healthy again, or with those types of foods, they're going to have those good probiotics in there.
Yeah, I agree with that. Any kind of you know, that fermented thing like, you know, cabbage, sauerkraut, mm-hmm. And everything that Robin listed for a probiotic is definitely beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another question that I think touches on probiotics. This is on our WMRA's Virginia Insight page on Facebook. This is from Sue, who says, I am always hungry. I can be eating a large meal, know that I have probably already ingested much more than I need, but my hunger shut-off switch simply does not work. I've tried all kinds of tactics, drinking lots of water before a meal, eating very slowly, putting only small portions on my plate, and wide variations of types of food. The only thing that sometimes helps is if I consume a lot of caffeine with a meal. A friend recently said I should try probiotics. Any thoughts?
I do not know of any conclusive research on that.
Yeah, I've never heard anything about caffeine. Caffeine is a stimulant. I don't need any research about that, but as far as the probiotics, you're thinking about things that I would probably go more into the realm of the prebiotics, the more of the fibrous types of food that's going to actually kind of sit in your, it's going to pass
through.
Give
me some examples.
Things like higher fiber breads. I know that Robin's not a big gluten, but
aren't there vegetables?
Yeah, vegetables, cruciferous types of vegetables like broccoli. Cauliflower, you know, what we're talking about, you know, sauerkraut, those types of things are very fibrous. So things like that is going to help you feel satiated longer. It's also going to help out, you know, it's kind of double. It helps reduce your LDL cholesterol levels if you have a high fibrous diet, and also help with gut health too. So
not only just the fiber in there, but the micronutrients. So, you know, I don't know exactly what she's eating, but making sure that you really are getting those micronutrient dense foods, because that's what nourishes the cell at that cellular level, and that's what turns off your hunger signal. And also getting in a good amount of fat. I think if you're lacking fat and healthy, good healthy fats, you know, olive oil, avocado, coconut oil, those sorts of things. If those aren't in your meal, you're going to be hungry. We need fat.
Remind me to get back to this excess hunger issue, because I think there are several other aspects to this. But suddenly we've got lots of calls, so let's make room for some of them. Next to Lexington, Khaki, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Robin Cole and or Jeremy Akers, please.
Yes. Could you please address Greek yogurt and cottage cheese as far as being probiotics?
I would certainly say that there are probiotics in them, but they're not beneficial to our gut at all. The inflammation that dairy causes on your GI tract is going to outweigh any probiotic source in there far more than you could ever benefit from it. That doesn't go into the acid load that it's going to put on your body, or the fact that only 30% of calcium in dairy is even absorbed. So I would certainly steer, if you're eating Greek yogurt or cottage cheese, I wouldn't be eating them for probiotics.
Actually, if you look at things like yogurt, that level actually goes up to about 60%. I think she's doing research that actually looks at the consumption of just drinking milk.
Level of what goes up to 60%?
The absorption rate of calcium.
Okay.
I think if you're looking at Greek yogurt, pretty much the only difference is that it's actually strained, so it's a higher protein type of level. But if you look at things, you know, different types of like Faye, those types of things, they have every single one of the probiotics that that you need, so you don't have to get it from different other sources. So, you know, in my view, if you don't have a protein allergy, if you don't have, if you're not lactose intolerant, I think that yogurt, things like kefir type of milk, that's kind of a mix between milk and yogurt, is a very good source of probiotics. Again, you know, given
so, Khaki, it sounds to me like we've got one expert who says Greek yogurt would be good, and one expert who says if you want something that gives you a probiotic effect, it'd be better to do something that's not dairy.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so we're going to thank Khaki for getting us on that point. And I think we got another point coming in from Harrisonburg. This is Ron. Ron, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please. Hey, Ron, you still there? Okay, I think maybe we've lost Ron. Following up what Khaki was saying, if she's going to take your route of staying away from dairy, Robin Cole, mm-hmm. as opposed to Jeremy, who mm-hmm. seems to disagree with you on that point, what foods specifically should she be eating to encourage a probiotic effect in her digestive tract?
Yeah, miso is one of the best foods. You can incorporate that into salad dressings and sauces. Unpasteurized sauerkraut, so make sure you're looking for it in the refrigerated section of the grocery store, certainly not in cans or anything. You want it to be live. And kombucha tea is really great. Probably not the most economical choice, but certainly that has great probiotics in it. And people actually don't realize that a high-quality dark chocolate is still going to have probiotics in it. Dark chocolate, so over 70%. You're going to look for a high quality, preferably organic dark chocolate.
But you probably don't want to pig out.
Yes, I would say certainly keep portion sizes under control. About the size of two, your index finger and your middle finger.
Here in the Insight Studio, nutrition advisor and registered dietitian Robin Cole, as well as nutrition researcher and registered dietitian Jeremy Akers. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight, 888-WMRA Talk, how to reach us by phone. Let's see if we can squeeze in Bruce's question before we go to the break. Bruce in Charlottesville, thanks for calling in.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. I've watched a show called Forks Over Knives that's on Netflix, and it's pushing a no meat, no chicken, no fish, no dairy, whole grain diet. And I was on that for a couple of weeks and did very well with it, but it kind of leveled out. And so I was looking at a thing today on the internet, and it was talking about soy products being bad for you. Like I've been using a lot of Morningstar soy meat substitutes. But it was saying that all these soy products, because of the preservatives, are bad for you. So if you can't eat dairy and you can't eat soy, you limit yourself pretty good. Does anybody have any opinions on that?
Bruce, that sounds like an absolutely wonderful question. I hope you can hold on, because I know the rest of us want to hold on for the answer. We have to go to the break right now, but we'll be back in just a bit more than 1 minute. Our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight, registered dietitian from James Madison University, Jeremy Akers, and registered dietitian from the Revolution Health Center in Scottsville, Virginia, Robin Cole. We've still got some phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. I'm Tom Graham. So we had Bruce's question saying that he went on a non-meat diet, at least at first, felt better, but then he started reading some stuff about soy not being so good for you.
Yeah. So I would certainly agree that soy is probably not that good for you. If anything, I would say maybe some tempeh here and there, since it's fermented and it does have probiotics, which goes on along with our last question. But if people, you know, there is such thing as being a junk food vegan as well. And that's when it comes down to the more processed your food is, the more acidic. I would certainly say go out go out and eat a piece of grass-fed beef before you'd eat a lot of processed soy in the form of Morningstar or something. So that's probably why he's not feeling as good. I would certainly recommend, you know, beans and lentils and things for a source of protein versus Morningstar. But they are a good transition food, but certainly not something that you're going to want to stick on. So even making something as simple as a homemade veggie burger is going to take you a lot farther than Morningstar and soy products. And that goes along with, like I said, the higher it's going to be processed.
Bruce, does that respond to your question?
Yeah, I think it's just you have soy, but limit it.
Yeah.
Limit it just like you would in portions of meat or whatever.
Yeah, I would probably stay as far away as I could from the packaged and boxed stuff.
And you would like him to be eating a lot more vegetables and
absolutely.
Fruits.
Absolutely. So really,
what about nuts and seeds?
Nuts and seeds too. But at the base of the food pyramid, and this goes against what the USDA is saying, but at the base of the food pyramid should be fruits and vegetables. Those should be 50 to 60% of your diet. And then from there, you know, beans, grains, and some healthy fats in the form of nuts and seeds and avocado, coconut oil.
What about those vegetables in soup?
Oh, do those count? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
As long as it's not canned, processed
as long as
soup.
No. It's a scratch.
Yep. Like, make a good homemade veggie soup, and that can... A soup is essentially a salad if it has enough vegetables, especially in the winter when it's cold.
And
I was looking at recipes yesterday for a heart-healthy soup. I think it's called Sacred Heart Soup.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no meat in it. And the only thing it recommended, a beef base.
Just use a veggie broth.
Somebody was saying use veggie broth instead.
Yep, just a veggie broth can substitute for that.
And okay. Bruce, there are a lot of recipes on the internet for veggie type of burgers. I agree with mm-hmm. Robin that if that's what you're going to stick with, that definitely get away from things that you get down the frozen food aisle.
Well, I was thinking more like I use a lot of beef crumbles, like in soups, like the Morningstar beef crumbles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just substitute a can of beans if you want to.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, folks, so much.
Absolutely.
Bruce, thanks for your call. We have this on Facebook from Skyler who says, how much of your diet is supposed to be protein? What kinds of supplements are worth using? Two good questions.
So the answer to the first, if you look at the tradition, we would need about 12 to 35% of our diet. Our calories are supposed to be coming from protein. I'm probably a little bit more into the higher, around 17, 18%. I definitely don't think it should be up to 35%. As far as supplements, I am anti-supplements. Mm-hmm. I'm not a big supplement person, and I think Robin's sitting here agreeing with me
I
think everything should come from your food. We eat enough in our diet now that we are we're pretty fed right now. But I mean, if you have the right composition, if you're increasing your fruits and vegetables. And
that's
you have
interesting
a very
that
balanced,
you say that because we just had a story on Morning Edition this morning, and I remember just a couple of weeks ago on the very popular public radio program Radio Lab, which we air here, they talked about scientific studies where probiotic supplements were being added either to human diets or in experiments with mice. And in both of these reports, they were talking about very positive effects on all kinds of health conditions, even such things as depression and mental disorders. But it sounds to me like what you're saying is those scientists should have gotten the mice to be eating fermented.
Well, if you look at the mouse child, yeah, I think they should. But you look at a lot of the research; they are comparing it to what is typical. And what is typical is an unhealthy diet. What is typical is, like I said before, is a very energy-dense diet where we have a lot of processed food, a lot of sodium. So when you're talking about...
But if somebody's beginning to recover from one of those diets, do you think it will not help them at all
to be
taking a probiotic supplement?
I would not recommend supplements because that's again, instant gratification. And at the end of the day, we're not getting to the root of the problem. So yeah, it might help. Supplements are expensive. And two, you might as well just shift your diet as much as you can and really just start pushing that money into really wholesome food because that a supplement.
But what's
going to
taste
abandoned.
Better? I mean, I agree with Robin. What's going to taste better, taking a pill or actually sitting down and, eating some greens, mm-hmm. put something on it, put a little bit of vinegar on it, a little mm-hmm. balsamic. I mean, that tastes and it's a whole lot more satisfying than taking a pill.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when we look at Well, Robin's talking about instant gratification, and we want to be able to take a pill to get healthy because it's the easier way out. I think we need to go back to the way we used to. We didn't have pills. We were able to actually just look at our food, research our food, and be able to put actually meals together to nourish us.
Robin Cole, part of Skylar's question here about how much of your diet is supposed to be protein reminds me of something I think I might have read on one of your blog posts, that there are certain kinds of foods that you can combine that end up creating protein, like brown rice and seeds. Am I remembering this correctly?
You probably read something about how I was probably debunking that.
Oh, okay.
Because you actually don't have to combine it all in one meal. You don't have to eat beans with rice, or you don't have to eat peanut butter with whole wheat bread. But as long as it is good to get a variety of plant-based proteins in your diet. And actually, our bodies are really smart enough. Jeremy talked about our bodies being really efficient machines, and they are. So think about it as a pearl necklace. That's what a protein is. When you digest it, all those pearls come off the string, and you're left with amino acids. So then when your body needs to make an enzyme, or it needs to build muscle tissue again, it actually is going to pull from all your endogenous sources along with the stuff you're eating and the proteins you're eating to make a complete protein. So our bodies are actually really efficient.
What are some of those elements that if you ingest them over time, you're creating a complete protein, as you put it?
So whole grains, vegetables can actually be upwards of 40 to 50% protein.
Whole grains, I often think of bread, but talking about brown rice.
I'm thinking more about quinoa, buckwheat, wild rice, amaranth, if anyone has heard of that. Those are actually what we call pseudo grains, and they're actually going to be higher in protein than something like whole wheat. So shooting for those, even whole wheat, though, is going to have some protein in it. Nuts and seeds. Almost every single food is going to have protein in it. The problem is when we start eating plants, a lot of times people aren't eating enough volume of that.
Now, if you have a little bit of meat, that is a complete protein. You don't have to combine things.
Yeah, but then you're getting instant gratification.
And meat is secondhand protein.
And you're not being creative with your meals. Hey, we're going to Timberville next. Rodney, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for our guests.
Yes, I actually... More on a diet scale. What I'm actually after is I don't have a colon anymore. They actually did build me what's called a J pouch, and what I seem to have problems with at times is acid actually coming out of me very strongly. And I've changed my diets repeatedly. Simple breakfast, light milk. I wonder if somebody could give me some recommendations on what they would do to say actually reduce the acidity coming out of me.
I think yours is more of actually not a food type of acidity. It's more of like an acid that's coming from your stomach. You got to think your stomach is very acidic. I think things that like higher fat foods, it's one of the definitely things if you don't have a colon, it reduce your higher fat foods. Like spicier foods can have a acid change the acid of your stomach. And again, this is the gastric acid that's actually digested your food. I think things even, and this is one of the things I'll agree with, like the milk, milk doesn't coat your stomach. Milk can cause an acid buildup, especially if you're intolerant to that. If you're not having a colon, it's one of the things where you have to decrease the amount of the prebiotics that you're intaking. You can't have a large amount of that because your body, it just can't process it fast enough. The spicier foods, sodas, carbonation, those types of things will cause a little bit of the acid buildup in your stomach.
I would recommend, have you tried like a smoothie type of thing, like a green smoothie or something?
No, I actually haven't. I actually do a very light breakfast of a whole grain cereal, light milk, try to stay away from most spicy things, do a lot of rices and noodles, but still at times there just doesn't seem like enough time or enough time to absorb the acids, and I noticed that.
Yeah, I would certainly recommend switching to maybe try it in the morning time, even a fruit smoothie with an almond milk or coconut milk, something non-dairy, or a green smoothie would be even better. That can be one, giving you more nutrients and super easy to digest.
Rodney, thanks so much for your call. We're going to run short on time here soon, but we probably could fit in one more call if you dialed in right now at 888-WMRA-TALK. I think you'd even find one of our lines open. But we're going now to Shenandoah County. Kathy, thanks for joining us. Your question and comment either for registered dietitian and nutrition researcher Jeremy Akers or registered dietitian and nutrition consultant Robin Cole, please?
Hi. I tried to talk and it wouldn't come out. Sorry. And I know we're short on time. Okay. I have been doing the little, all the little tricks you guys have been talking about. I can't eat peanut butter. It gives me indigestion. But I put my granola, instead of putting milk on it, I put yogurt on it. You know, all the good stuff. I feel better. It helps my day. But I do own chickens. I do have free-range eggs, you know, nice bright yellow yolks, blah, blah, blah. But I feed them corn. And everybody, even the organic farm people, feed their chickens corn. I do feed them some table scraps and, you know, what helps, you know, kind of hit their little garbage disposal. But
Kathy, we are short on time. Is your question, is corn okay for chickens? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
okay. Hold on. We're going to get an answer for you. Does anybody have a response to Kathy's question about corn and chickens?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at
most of the... Could you get close to the microphone, please?
Sorry, Kathy. If you look at most of the corn industries, if they're not like a polyculture where the chickens are actually going scratching like the manure from the cows and stuff, and yours are free range if you don't have that type of farm, they will feed them cows. I think feed them corn. I think the biggest thing is like knowing where that corn comes from. Is it more of an organic? I would definitely not say table scraps because especially if you have processed foods that you're using, I don't think that's going to be beneficial. It may beef them up. It may make them bigger, but I would not recommend like the table scraps and just knowing where that corn comes from. But yeah, I mean, that is a popular, especially for chicken. Chickens, because of their stomachs, digest it a lot differently than, like, say, a cow, like something that has a ruminant. They actually cannot digest it. They have to have antibiotics to digest corn, but the chickens, they digest it. It's fine.
Kathy, thanks so much for your question. We lost Ron's call several minutes ago, but we did get a note about what he wanted to ask. So let me read some of this here. He says, since we have acid in our stomachs, what good is an alkaline diet? Won't everything just become acidic once it goes into our stomachs?
No. So our stomachs are acidic. That's the point. For them to digest food, but when we're talking about alkaline and acidity, we're talking about the acid or alkaline residue. So what's left after it's metabolized. And, you know, carbohydrates start getting metabolized up in your mouth with your salivary amylase. And then, you know, the different proteins are starting to get metabolized, you know, at different places in the body. And therefore, not everything is getting metabolized right in the stomach. So while the stomach is acidic, it's not turning everything acid as it goes throughout the body.
Yeah. I mean, you got to think our stomach is about as acidic as a car battery. Mm-hmm. And then when we go into the small intestines, it makes it very basic. We have enzymes that are released to make it basic in order to be able to get the food absorbed. So it's like we said earlier, it's a very functional process and a very amazing process that our body has.
Mm-hmm. Ron, sorry, we lost your call, but glad we got at least part of your question on the air. We're going, I think this is going to be our last call, if we can do it quickly, to Stanton. Dave, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, hi. I'm a huge fan of micro-brewed beers, and we got a lot of great breweries here in Virginia. And I've found that over the weekend when I imbibe and I've had a good time all weekend, maybe had too many of those to drink on Sunday evening and even carrying it over into Monday, I just feel bloated and there's indigestion going on and all. And, yeah, it's probably because I had too many beers, but, hey, what is going on exactly, like on a microbial level? And is there something I can do on, like, Sunday evening or Monday to, like, kind of set things right with the world? Is there something I can eat or what's happening there?
Drink lots of water.
I would well, certainly with beer. I'm more of a wine kind of girl myself, but beer has gluten in it, so gluten could be contributing to a lot of... I'm not saying all gluten is bad. The food industry has just made gluten bad in our food system now, but that beer is probably full of a lot of gluten, which is making you bloated, along with, you know, all the other kind of GI distress that comes along with drinking lots of beer. But I would certainly, you know, hydrate well, get yourself some good micronutrient dense food. A green smoothie would be great, or a big salad. And then certainly, you know, just making sure, again, you're well hydrated.
So think of it this way. When you drink alcohol, your body has to get rid of that first. And so whatever you have stored as far as carbohydrates, fats, proteins, your body has to get rid of that alcohol first. And so it slows down your metabolic processes. And through that, is what makes you feel sluggish, makes you feel bloated. You also got to think the amount of calories that you consume. If you're kicking back, you know, 5 or 6 beers, that could be upwards of 600-700 calories. You think of also looking about water retention, because to get rid of that, we have to increase our water intake, that load on our kidneys. So it is sodium retention, so we can actually get rid of that process. So if you, you know, kick back and drink a lot where we don't have the, you know, our body really metabolizes it first and you have to slow down, your other metabolic process slow down.
Dave, thanks for getting us thinking about beer, even though it sounds like we shouldn't be drinking a lot of it. It was a nice final question to end with. Our guests have been Jeremy Akers, Professor of Health Sciences at James Madison University, Robin Cole, Director of Nutrition for the Scottsville, Virginia-based medical group, the Revolution Health Center, plus earlier in the broadcast, Charlottesville-based family practice physician Greg Gilbert. Gang, thanks so much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find postings of Virginia Insight through the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. I haven't had any beer today, I promise. When you get to that page for today's Virginia Insight broadcast, you will find links to more information about each of our guests and the work they're doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.